Hi, I'm Susan Moore, Community Engagement Manager with IIBA.
And I'm Scott Bennett, Manager of Business Analysis with the International Institute of Business Analysis.
And this is Business Analysis Live.
Susan, what do you think of when you hear neuroscience?
I think, oh, I didn't know I needed to be a scientist in order to do this work, right? It sounds like you need to bring a whole other set of skills, but really where I think some thought leaders, including our guest today, are thinking about the neuroscience is how we can incorporate some of the research and some of the concepts to help us have better relationships with our stakeholders, to be more effective communicators with our teams, to be more effective leaders. Because we often talk here about business analysis being a relationship business, but part of that relationship business is being able to understand other folks. So that's right. Where neuroscience comes in.
Yeah. So if you're interested in upping your communication skills, your relationships, your leadership skills, today is an episode for you. So let's get our guest join us. It might be a little bit confusing today. There's going to be two Scotts on here. Please welcome Scott Helmers.
I'm the other Scott.
The other Scott, but certainly an awesome Scott. So welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. It's nice to be back.
Yeah. We really, people might know you from some of the IIBA webinars that you've done. Heck, mm-hmm. They might know you from LinkedIn Learning because you are, as your headline says, a Microsoft Visio MVP. That might be a whole other Business Analysis Live in the future. But maybe just introduce yourself. Tell the folks that may not know you a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I've never actually held the title business analyst. I'm one of those folks, but I've been BA adjacent for a significant majority of the time I've been working. Back in the earliest days, I actually worked for a couple of computer companies, did some software network technology support, that kind of thing. That's long past. For the last 25, 6, 7 years, something in that range, I've principally been a business process consultant. So a lot of what I do is work with organizations that need to identify how they're currently doing work. And I don't know about anybody watching today, but it surprised me initially how much work gets done in especially larger organizations, but even medium and small sized organizations, and people can't tell you how it's happening. It does. Yeah. So a lot of our consulting work has been to help identify what is the actual business process that's going on here, help organizations map those processes, and then in many cases, not always, but in many cases, look at that current state process and say, okay, how do we make this better? Some organizations, it's fine just to get to the point of actually having a well-documented process so that they can transfer knowledge to new employees, so they can retain knowledge when people leave the organization. But for many, it's about, okay, that's good, but it's not good enough. How can we analyze this process and improve the process? And that, by the way, is a topic we'll talk more about later mm-hmm. on, because I'm going to talk about some of that with you folks in the fall. But
yeah. Hold that's that. Right. And, you know, as you were talking about the work that you've done in process improvement, I mean, I know it sounds like a lot of that is just, I ask you what your process is, you tell me what your process is, and I write yep. it down. But really, the element here that makes this successful is that you are able to talk with, work with, interact with, collaborate with these all folks in a way they tell you the explicit information, but mm-hmm. also that they are comfortable enough sharing with you maybe information that isn't so explicit. So that hidden right. stuff, that's right. a real skill. Yeah. And maybe that's where some of that neuroscience interest that you have has come in.
It definitely is. I think one of the things that a point I've made to many people many times in the last 20 plus years is that If you're someone responsible for gathering knowledge about it, let's say a work process or anything, you know, a set of requirements, whatever the case might be, you're going to talk to a lot of people. And some of those conversations will be one-on-one, some will be small group conversations. Sometimes they're in organized workshops and you are acting as the facilitator in a workshop. Mm-hmm. The point that I've made many times is that being a facilitator is almost like being a superhero. In fact, I have a slide I use sometimes that has a Superman logo and a Wonder Woman logo that appear when I'm describing the attributes of a good facilitator, because the number one skill is to be able to ask good questions and then stop and then shut up, if you will.
Right.
And many people who fail at being good facilitators don't understand that. They want to be the smartest person in the room. They want to ask the question and then answer it. And no.
Yeah.
It's interesting how that one skill of just stopping a conversation and letting the silence take over, because mentally what kicks in is people feel uncomfortable. So one of the questioning techniques that I use is when we're creating a list of things in a workshop, I'll say, what else, and stop.
Yeah.
And what it does is it cognitively makes people think, oh, I have to answer something here. So what else needs to be on that list? You keep doing that until you max them out and they don't have any more ideas. Then you move on to the next thing.
Right. So I put together, actually my business partner, Mike, and I put together years ago, 20 questions, a 20 questions list. Okay. And it includes, ways to get an audience engaged and get the conversation started. And of those, I forget which number it is, 17 or something, wherever I put it, my favorite question is, what happens next? And it's just like you, Scott. It's what happens next, and then don't say a word. Just let that silence build for a moment or two or three, and let people's brains engage.
Right. Yeah.
All of us, part of what's fascinating to me, and I'll come back to how my interest in neuroscience in just a second, but part of what fascinates me is the different ways in which people's brains actually work. I mean, there's a certain similarity amongst all of us in terms of how our brains work, but different people respond to different cues. They respond differently to the same cues. Some people need more silence in that setting we were talking about in order to get engaged, to be able to step back for just a second and say, oh, maybe I'll say this, or I think this is relevant. Other people just want to be the first one to jump in. And sometimes part of your role as a facilitator is to help that anxious person to be a little less anxious and to help a little less, at least to pause before they help.
Yeah, for sure. So there's lots of different things that we can use, cues and techniques. Scott, how did you get involved in sort of understanding neuroscience?
Yeah. It's actually a long time thing. In fact, I thought of this yesterday and forgot to do it, but I believe on a bookshelf in my family room downstairs is the first serious book I ever bought after college. And I remember buying it in an actual bookstore back when, there were those things, and that's what we did. I remember buying it because it was called the Brain Book, or some totally simple title. Okay. And I'd always had this slight interest in the subject of the human brain, but not academically. So I bought this serious adult book, and I remember reading it and thinking, oh, that was really pretty interesting. And I put it on the shelf and pretty much didn't even think about the subject again for a very long time. And then, I don't know, it was 15 years ago, something like that, I went to a presentation by a gentleman named David Rock, whose name will come up several times during the webcasts I'll be doing with you folks in the next couple of months. And he was captivating. First of all, as a presenter, I really enjoyed the theater. As Susan knows, I'm a bit of a theater geek, and I do perform a little bit or help run theater companies and that sort of thing. And so I enjoyed the theater aspect of how he presented, but it was the underlying message that really grabbed me. And so I got his book and I read it and started exploring from there. And I just got, the more I looked into how the brain works and what effects that has on our daily lives, it became even more intriguing to me. So I am not a neuroscientist. I don't play one on stage. I just happen to be somebody who's intrigued by this thing we all carry around.
Yeah.
We really underestimate, I think, how much our brain impacts just what we do in business analysis. I know that we tend to think about ourselves and the value and the skills that we bring. But we all have that, all of those things which drive us as humans and as professionals in a workplace. And, you know, sometimes those spill out and, you know, we just need to be aware of, you know, or have an awareness, I think, of what things are motivators, are demotivators, you know, because I think it's an important part of how we build that into our communication.
One of the things that David Rock and other neuroscientists talk about is that there are several fundamental organizing principles of our brains. And one, we've all heard the expression fight or flight. And that's this basic human reaction to external stimuli. You know, we see something that we either want to run toward it or we want to run away from it. Or if we want to hold our ground, that's where the fight might come in. I've also heard fight or flight referred to as fight, flight, or freeze, because there are those things that trigger us to not be able, and we aren't able to do anything.
Okay.
But with a little luck in a work setting, most of us are not in situations where we actually face something suddenly that makes us want to completely run away or completely run in that direction. But what's really fascinating to me is that it is often the brain trying to minimize danger or maximize reward. Its response our brains respond to social cues and things people say to us or other people react to things we say in very much the same way that our brain reacts to physical stimuli. And so what's intriguing is to realize and to come to appreciate a little bit more how much what I say to Susan can affect her for not just today, but potentially tomorrow or the next day. We all know that at some level, we can say things that are hurtful intentionally or otherwise. We can say things that are complimentary, hopefully intentionally and hopefully often. But what's intriguing to me is the potential long-term effects of seemingly innocent remarks or seemingly innocent social situations. So part of what this guy David Rock talks about a lot is how our brains look for certain elements in our interactions with each other and how we can be aware of those things in order to be able to communicate more effectively or help a team work together more effectively by recognizing that people look for status. And I'll just talk about one thing now that I'll go into a bit more detail on. David Rock uses an acronym called SCARF, that he refers to five ways that our brains tend to look at the world through a lens of status, of certainty, autonomy, fairness, and relatedness, or relatedness and fairness. Those are the elements of his SCARF model. So, for example, take status. When I meet somebody for the first time, I usually am not consciously doing this, but one of the things he talks about is my brain is sizing that person up and saying, okay, what's my status compared to this person? And it's when we meet somebody that we also go through the same sort of friend or foe analysis. And usually this is going on completely unconsciously or subconsciously, but it's happening. And being aware that it's happening can make us sensitive to it and make us respond more effectively. So if I'm aware that when I met Scott Bennett for the first time, my brain says, is he a friend or is he a foe? That helps me to appreciate that he's probably doing the same thing in his brain. And so what can I do to make him veer toward the friend rather than automatically assume I'm a foe?
That's interesting. Wow.
I'm thinking about conversations that I've had with members and other folks where they talk about, oh gosh, I've just got this really difficult stakeholder that I need to work with. And if I'm hearing you right, one of the questions that we might ask ourselves is potentially that person might be difficult, not because they are difficult, but because something that's happening is triggering that I'm in danger response. Mm-hmm. And so how is we, how can we as business analysts then start to think about building trust with that person, asking questions of that person so that we can either help to identify where they might be feeling a little out of control, or help to help ourselves to eliminate whatever danger they perceive we're bringing in, right? Because danger isn't the tiger that's going to jump out of the closet and get you, but it could be, I might lose my job, or why is this person here? Or
Something at a very fundamental level. So let me take the A in autonomy, the A in scarf. So maybe that person reacts as he or she does because they think I'm threatening their autonomy. I'm doing things, or I'm asking things, or I'm saying things that make that person feel like they're going to have less control going forward. And if that's a person for whom autonomy is a very high need, then that could be part of what's affecting their reaction to me.
Yeah.
So that's a very good point.
So for our viewers today that are live, ask your questions in the comments. We'll certainly get to those. And we are touching on some of these at a very high level, because we do have some events coming up that Scott will be speaking at that will go into these in more detail. Susan, why don't you tell us about what those events are?
Well, we have got a couple of webinars, a webinar series that he is going to be doing with IIBA. And I think, Roslyn, you've got those links. So if you'll drop those in, if you're an IIBA member, this is free for you. Scott is going to go into all of the detail of what he's been talking about today. That's an April and then a May webinar. But he's also going to be talking about this at BBC, which is coming up in April. Also, I think a shorter version of this, but so he's going to be speaking about it there. Also at BBC, he's going to be showing his Vizio magic. I know we haven't talked about the Vizio MVP. I mentioned it at the top, but he's actually also doing an advanced business and our advanced Vizio skills for business analysts. He's magic, by the way, with Vizio. We've got some of those in our archive. If you want to see some impressive Vizio skills, they don't give that MVP out for nothing.
and by the way, I didn't mention this when I introduced myself before, but my Vizio knowledge comes directly out of doing business process work. In fact, it was about 16 or 17 years ago that three of us at the time working at Harvard Computing Group were constantly faced with clients who couldn't find a good way, nor could we guide them to an easy way to document their processes with anything more than flowcharts. And the problem with flowcharts is most of them tend to be nothing more than text on boxes. And sure, there's value in the picture, there's value in seeing the flow, but if the only thing on a box is a few words and you have a bunch of boxes with a bunch of words, there's so much you don't know about the process. It's just not there. So we devised a different way called TaskMap, taskmap.com, a different way to document processes that are so that the maps are content rich, they're full of data about the process and data that's visualized in important ways and useful ways. And I mentioned that as an aside because it was developing that add-in for Vizio called TaskMap that I ended up learning a little bit about Vizio and started sharing knowledge online. And that was what occasioned my being named by Microsoft as an MVP. So I've learned a lot about Vizio in the context initially of documenting work processes.
And I'm a huge fan of Vizio. I love Vizio diagrams. So I've watched a couple of your presentations, Scott. So I can attest they are great presentations. You're going to learn, even if you're an expert, you're going to learn something from Scott.
Believe me, you're going to learn something. So let's see. All right. So don't forget, we are live and we're taking your questions today. What do you want to know about how to incorporate some neuroscience into the work that you do as business analysis professionals? Drop that into the comments. Well, okay. So let's, Scott B, you have a question?
I do. We had talked a little bit earlier, Scott, about the whole brain model. It sounded interesting. So is that something you could pull up on the screen so that we can share that with people?
Funny you should ask. I just happen to have
Happen to have it right here. Yeah,
so for those of you that are listening to the audio podcast of this, Scott has a diagram here. We'll walk through with words some of it, but I encourage you to check out the YouTube video so you can actually see this, so you can get some value out of that.
So this diagram, this is basically what's on the screen, is a circle divided into four quadrants that are yellow. Well, let me start with the one labeled A is blue, the one labeled B is green, the one labeled C is red, and then the D quadrant is yellow. And those correspond to thinking styles in the brain. And this diagram and the work that led to its creation and its use is the basis for the May webcast that I'll be doing. The whole brain model was devised by a gentleman named Ned Herrmann based on research that he did in the 90s, in the 80s into the 90s, published the first version of something called the Whole Brain Book in 1995. And his notion is that just as Myers-Briggs, that many of you are probably familiar with, that is aimed at helping us identify personality types and personality styles so that we can work together with people whose personalities are similar and those whose personalities are different. In Ned Herrmann's case, it's about thinking styles. And so someone in the A quadrant is somebody who values the facts, the data. Somebody in the B quadrant is highly organized. And these things are a blend. We're all a blend of these four thinking styles. So B is someone highly organized. Think project manager. Think the person who loves to create the agenda for the meeting that's coming up. The interpersonal quadrant, the C quadrant, is people who are looking more or thinking more continually about the emotional state of affairs in the room, or what effect what I'm going to propose will have on you or this group of people. The D quadrant, the yellow quadrant, is the creative quadrant. So these are the free thinkers, the, you know, rules. Don't talk to me about rules. I just want to do what I want to do. You can probably all relate to one or all of those quadrants in yourself or in people you work with. But the idea is there's a formal instrument devised by Ned Herrmann, much like Myers-Briggs for personality types, that helps you to identify you and your thinking preferences. So let me just put this, for example. Here's one profile that might be a real person. So this is a person who tends toward the creative and the interpersonal thinking styles. They have some preferences in the factual and the organized sections, but they tend to be on the right half of the diagram, say, in terms of their thinking. Here's someone who is very much just the facts, ma'am. So this is all about the data. Yeah, there's a little bit of creativity. There's a little bit of that interpersonal stuff, but mostly don't bother me with all those emotions. Just let me organize things and build my plans around data. And then there's, you know, this profile where we might have more stronger interpersonal emotional components to our thinking, quite a bit less on the factual or data oriented side, but still fairly strong in the creative. And so it's the big point of all of this is that no one of us is a truly balanced thinker. I shouldn't say none. According to Ned Herrmann, there are about 5% of people who are truly balanced and use all four thinking styles continually. Most of us skew in one or several directions and therefore skew out of the others. So here are three potential thinking styles. And one of these is actually me. I've done the Herrmann assessment. I'm not gonna tell you which one it is today. If you wanna know, you'll have to either guess or come to the April.
Or come to the webinar.
What's that, Susan?
Or come to the webinar in April or in May. Yeah.
In April, May. Yes, thank you. In May, we'll be talking about this. But so in any event, the big basic premise here is that because so few of us are truly balanced in our thinking styles, it takes a team to think, to have a whole brain.
A whole brain. Yeah.
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 Sort of funny to think about, but true, because we do need that balance. I think that's often why We talk about wanting a diversity of voices, of perspectives mm-hmm. on a team, and how that diversity makes us a better operating team, organization, or whatever. And I think this is some of the science behind why that is so important, because you do need all of these different yeah. parts represented.
Yeah, and I can see using it in a couple different ways, right? I mean, as a leader, if you understand your team and, you know, who's the most organized type of person, you know, sort of letting the work flow towards the personality types will probably help those people and help the mm-hmm. team. But also as a communicator, you know, if I'm facilitating a workshop and I've got someone that's really, really organized, but my facilitation technique is sort of a little bit haphazard, it's going to drive that person nuts, and probably yeah. they're going to disengage mentally yeah. versus if we use a more organized approach. So I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, but we can't communicate always all the time, but we need correct. To be cognizant and use a variety, right?
That's absolutely true. And you know, to draw on two things you mentioned, number one, if I am a leader, part of my, with this kind of knowledge base, part of what I can do is help, is build a team. You know, as I'm bringing new people on board, I can strive to build a team that has thinking diversity in the same way that I might try to do with other types of diversity. And the fact that thought style diversity is important doesn't in any way reduce the importance of other types of diversity in a team. But this is another very important aspect. And the other comment too is that you're right about people getting disengaged. So think about this if you're running a meeting. Think about this if you're providing training. What is it that I need to do to keep the fact-oriented people engaged in my presentation at moments, and yet also be able to have the people who are constantly thinking about the effects of their actions on others and the effects of this new knowledge on others? How do I keep them engaged? How do I keep the free thinkers engaged? And yes, as you pointed out, the highly organized folks too. So it's a tightrope. I mean, we're walking this rope trying to do all these things, but at least if you're conscious of the fact that other people's brains just work differently, you'll be better armed.
Yeah, it really is a step up from just going in there with no awareness of that. I'm thinking about those, you know, like this kind of awareness might not be for everyone, but I think particularly as AI becomes more of a differentiator in business analysis, meaning if I am a business analyst who uses AI, this kind of skill set, knowing how to work with people, really is what differentiates me from AI, mm-hmm. Because AI doesn't have any kind of personality, really any kind of thinking, right? But I've still got to work with people in order to, you know, to get projects done. So right. having a skill set that helps me to work better with people, I think is good. But the other thing that I think about too, I was thinking, you know, what if somebody is listening today and they're more on the factual side of things and they're thinking, "Ooh, this thinking style's like, I don't have time for this. I am one of those people that doesn't care about emotions." Like, what do we say to those folks about how they might incorporate this? How do we make a case for this is kind of important, even though you might be somebody who just wants to deal with the facts?
The biggest comment I would, or the primary comment I would make is it relates back to something Scott said also, and that is, You have to be aware that what you say and how you say it is likely to lose part of your audience on a regular basis, yeah. unless you are willing to and able to change a little bit at how you present or what you present or what you say or how you say it at different times.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're going to struggle even more to keep the communication going if you don't have some awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I find fascinating about this is we're talking about neuroscience, which is a science, yet using this is really an art form. Mm-hmm. There's no formula that someone can use to put this stuff together to be effective. It's an art. It's we're humans talking to yep. humans. As Susan loves to say, we're in a relationship business.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I've been guilty of this too. I often think about myself outside of work and myself at work, and that somehow I'm a different person, but you are not a different person at work. Like you may behave differently at work, but really who you are, what you bring with you, the triggers, the motivators, all of that stuff, you bring that with you. And so does everybody else. And that everybody else is dealing with the same stuff, especially after the pandemic, where it has just been really hard for a lot of folks. This makes you, if you bring this skill set, if you have this kind of awareness, it, I think, just makes you a better professional at work and being able to meet people where they are.
And you know, interestingly, I'm going to turn that 180 degrees, Susan, and say that I've learned as much about my wife's thinking styles as I have about anybody I work with. And it's been somewhat revelatory.
Right?
It's explained a number of things. Now that I have a better appreciation of why she does some of what she does, why I do or react in some of the ways that I do.
For our listeners out there, there's probably, these kinds of skills that you can use. They transcend the personal and the professional. And so when you can build this awareness, it's not just a tool that you can deploy at work. It's also something that you can use outside of work to just make all of your relationships better. So let's not forget that.
Yeah,
We have some questions, but do you want to sum that up, or do you have another thought, Scott Helmers?
I was just going to mention, this is the book that serves as the basis for what I will be doing in April during the webcast in April, and it is the points we were just making about the relationships between what happens at work and what happens at home are very much at the central part of that book. This is a book that describes that the four quadrants that we talked about and the research that Ned Herman did that resulted in this book. And that's the basis for much of what I'll have to say in May. There are strong relationships between those two topics, but that's more or less how I've divided my thinking on the subject, is around these two sets of ideas.
All right. I know that if you're an IIBA member, there is a summary version of the David Rock book, The Brain at Work. So if you want to dip your toe into it, you can find that summary there. And then you can find the full book probably at an online retailer of your choice. All righty.
And Susan, I'm just going to chime in there. If you're not an IIBA member, one of the benefits of being a member is you've got access to thousands and thousands of publications. In some cases, it's the full book. In some cases, it's the summary. So instead of having to read a full book, you can maybe get a 14 to 18 page summary, or it's an express way to be able to learn the material.
Yeah. And also there's audiobooks in there. Right. So if you prefer that style as well. Also, just being an IIBA member, you get to come here, Scott Helmers, talk about neuroscience and Visio. How about that? For a reason to join. Alrighty. So let's take the first question. This one's coming off YouTube today. So this is Valentina. So Valentina's question, what techniques can we use for difficult stakeholders? Because I do think this is a common issue, right? Our work is about change. Yeah. We know that's one of the things that can make people feel a little out of control. This may not be exactly a neuroscience question, but what are some of the techniques, or maybe what kinds of awareness from your research, Scott, could we bring into the techniques that we use when we have difficult stakeholders?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we touched on a little bit of this earlier, and that is, I referred to David Rock's SCARF model, and that was status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. Those five principles in our brains are constantly, they're filters that we are constantly using to judge what's going on in our interactions to the outside world. And so let's take the interaction with a specific stakeholder. That's, I think, having more awareness of those five things that are going on in the stakeholder's brain and what it is that we're doing personally that might be triggering a negative response, can we turn that in a way that it at least triggers a neutral response, if not something positive? So the April conversation we'll have is in much more detail about the five elements of the SCARF model and some of the ideas, some very specific ideas that you might be able to use, Valentina, in a situation with a difficult stakeholder.
The other thing I think we might consider here, if we already know that we are working with someone who might have some resistance to us being there, is we can start to plan some of this in advance, so that we're not just showing up and trying to figure out how to work our way out of a tense situation, but we mm-hmm. can have a plan for it going into it. And I think we had Kathy Berkage on a couple of years ago who talked about a stakeholder management canvas or something like that, where she brings a sense of mindfulness and thinking about what could happen. So that could be another way, is just to do the advance work.
Yeah. And in fact, just to carry that one step further and related to what I said a moment ago, let's take that notion of certainty, which David Rock says is critical for all of us at two varying degrees. If your work with this stakeholder suggests that one of the challenges they face is surprise, not liking surprise, not dealing well with uncertainty, can you do some of that prep work Susan mentioned to make sure that there aren't surprises of consequence for that person during a workshop or in a future interaction? So maybe you can help allay some of the fear of uncertainty by providing more certainty in advance.
Yeah, I think of another just general technique in terms of dealing with difficult stakeholders is peeling back layers of the onion. Try to understand where the concerns are coming from, because mm-hmm. if you can understand that root cause, you can start to build that relationship up potentially a little bit stronger. There's always difficult people that you encounter in your career. I can name three in 30 years, but there a lot of them you can overcome if you come to a common understanding. Sometimes it's a misunderstanding, a misinterpretation of things. It's really about communicating and working with them to understand where those concerns come from and alleviate some of those fears.
And it might be the SCARF model that you rely on. It might be the four thinking styles. It might be that when you and this person are together, one of you is one of your thinking styles is organized in one quadrant, and the other appears, now that you think about it, to be in a completely opposite 180 degree quadrant. Well, that's useful information. And there's one of the things we'll talk about in May when we look at the whole brain model is the fact that your thinking style or your thinking preferences may be very different from your job requirements, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be in that job. That just means you may need to adjust a little bit here or there. And that can be true in one-on-one interactions as well. So,
yeah, that's a good point. And I think one that I've been thinking about as we've been talking, that, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mismatch, but if you're aware of it, how could you build those skills? Because they'll be valuable. I know you guys are not going to believe this. We are actually at the end of our time together. We have flown through, right? This is really an incredible conversation. So Scott Helmers, I'm so glad that you're going to come back and do a two-part webinar series, because man, we need to unpack this more, and that's where you're going to do that. So we are so excited to hear more about this. So just IIBA members, I know Rosalind has dropped the link in for both sessions. You'll want to be there for this and tell your IIBA member friends, bring them along too. All right. Well, Scott Helmers, thank you so much for joining us today. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But it's always a great conversation.
It's a wonderful chat.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you both for hosting. It's great.
Yeah. So, in about 2 weeks, we're going to do this thing again, and we are going to focus on business architecture. We're going to answer the question, what is business architecture? Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. And we've got a guest, Roger Burlton, who's going to talk about that. He's written some books. So come back and learn more about it in 2 weeks. See ya. This is the end of our live session, but if you've got questions, you can send us an email at live@iiba.org or leave us a voice message and we'll answer your question at one of our upcoming broadcasts. Join us.